This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to Chris McVeigh of Octopus Investments, one of the UK's finest investors. So welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Paul. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, we've certainly had really two-speed stock markets so far this year, with the Magnificent Seven out in the States doing most of the heavy lifting. But now that the sort of interest rates hopefully are topping out as inflation comes down, what's your sort of outlook for the broader equity market, particularly your sort of sweet spot in sort of like, you know, small and mid-caps and income-paying stocks?
Yeah, it's been a frustrating period for the last, I think, 18 months or so, Paul. It's you know, we've been sitting here with companies delivering good updates, delivering good progress, you know, progress on revenues, progress on profits. Yes, macro's a bit of a challenge. Yes, interest rates are doing what they're doing, but these companies are ultimately delivering what they said they would do, and yet we've seen a derating. And it's, you know, it's been a frustrating time, but it's been a reassuring time that these companies are managing through the challenges that we are seeing around us. And they're managing well, and therefore I think they're, you know, as we see interest rates hopefully starting to get to that peak, and we've even seen speculation that Europe might start to cut later this year. We're pretty excited. We're growth equity investors. We're looking for companies that we ultimately believe have got significant growth potential, whether it's in the microcap fund that we manage there. You know, that tends to buy companies at the very, you know, sub 100 million market cap and then run them all the way up. We don't have any hard ceiling on when we sell these businesses, as long as we believe that there is scope for further upside to come and further growth to come. We also have a multi-cap income fund as well. And again, that's focusing on growth. That's looking for companies that we believe can grow earnings and therefore grow dividends ahead of the market through the cycle. And these companies are delivering. So yes, it's been a frustrating time, but, you know, particularly being a growth investor. But now where we are, we're pretty excited. We think, you know, valuations are at such attractive levels. They're ludicrously cheap levels. And we wrote an article last week, and it's called Ready for the Rebound. I mean, you know, we think it's here. We think valuations are at really attractive levels. Company multiples are, you know, sub 10 times in many cases for companies for quality growth, with great opportunities ahead of them. And when the market gets to these sorts of levels, it doesn't stay around here very long. We tend to see quite a quick rebound when the market turns. You know, ultimately, we believe that growth stocks will be the lead performers if we sit here in 12 months' time. Who knows? I may be wrong, but that's certainly the view that we're taking. And you know, we're pretty confident with the outlook, despite the frustrations of the last 18 months.
We're certainly going to go through a few of the growth stocks and in the next sort of like, you know, 60 minutes or so. But before we do that, one sort of like barrier to sort of particularly the sort of small cap area of sort of like multiple expansion or performance has been the fund manager redemptions. And given the attractive valuations, I know it's a $64 million question that you can't possibly answer, but I'll ask it anyway. When will that turn? When will we start seeing more money coming into the market to allow you guys to actually deploy more money into the stocks that you want to invest in?
I think, you know, we have to look at what has been attracting flows, and it's been the money market funds. And you know, that makes sense in a market that is, you know, that is pulling back. It makes sense. People want to lock in their 4 or 5, whatever it might be, percent. But when the market starts to stabilize and indeed people start to see some growth outperformance again, it won't take long before these flows start to come back. I was just looking at the stats before we came on here. And, you know, the IA, UK smaller company sector, looking back over the last 18 months to the end of last month, the market's down, what, 28%? Assets down 45%. That's a 16% negative flow. That's, you put that, the size of the sector roughly is about 10 billion just now. That's 2.8 billion of negative flows from UK smaller companies over that period. That's massive. And, all we have to see is a little bit of outperformance again. There'll be investor FOMO, and this market's very tight. The market maker books are very shallow. Liquidity, as you know, we're not blessed with lots of it down the smaller end of the market. It won't take a lot before these markets start to recover quite quickly.
Well, I'm looking forward to that moment, that's for sure.
So am I.
Well, let's just start with one of the sort of like the growth stocks that actually has done pretty well for you year to date. It's bucked the trend, is ActiveOps, which does sort of like robotic sort of software or automation software for the big banks and insurance companies. And I think it was priced about 70p back in January. And it's now trading at over a pound after some pretty good trading updates and has reached EBITDA positive. It does for sort of like hybrid working and workforce management and helps corporates improve their productivity. Do you want to give us your latest view on this one? Because it seems to have really turned a corner now and it reached an inflection point.
I think it's reached an inflection point from a sentiment perspective. It got to profitability a little bit ahead of expectations. The expectations that were set to the market when it floated a couple of years ago, I'd say it's modestly profitable. But we think, a mid 20% EBITDA margin is achievable in due course for this business. And it's all about its recurring revenues. It's 20 odd million of annual recurring revenues right now, but it's up by 11% year on year. And that's from, that's a relatively modest sales force, but this is a really nice product. It basically helps large corporates, as you say, manage disparate workforce, whether in the office or at home or remote working, whatever it might be. So it's a really good efficiency tool. It's not spying on your workers, it's an efficiency tool, and that's helping these companies manage their workforces better, drive margins, et cetera, good ROIs. So I think this business is in pretty, pretty good shape. Its market cap right now, despite the run, it's up what 30-odd%, you say, the year to date. But it's all, the recurring revenue is 20, 25 million. Heading towards 30 by the end of next year. And in a normal market, you'd expect to see that priced on 4 to 5 times recurring revenues. You say market cap right now is 75 million, so it's priced on 3 times historic numbers. So, there's still, if the numbers that we believe are correct, and we expect to see the recurring revenues grow at the rate they have been growing at, and indeed maybe accelerate as the business gets scale, I think there's still 50% upside in this thing on a relatively near term if valuations get to where they should get to. So, it remains very cheap in our view. It's had a good run year to date, but I think the upside here is still a long way to go. And people aren't yet valuing it really on an earnings multiple, and that will come in due course.
Yeah. It's got a shed load of cash as well, hasn't it? It's got about 15 million of cash, which I think is roughly around about 20p a share. So...
Exactly.
And that leaves it with the multiple comes down even further.
Exactly. And it leaves it scoped. If they want to go, more aggressively international, they can buy in some small technologies, which they have been buying in technologies in the past to help build out the product suite. There's more to go for here as well from that perspective. So yeah, I think it's in good shape. I think it's really exciting. So
okay.
It's nice. It's up 37% year to date. It's not many of those stocks around.
Well done. Big pat on the back. Now, a slightly bigger market cap company, FD Technologies, which is sort of like a IT. It's got a number of different moving parts, but the sort of most valuable things to be their KX Insights, sort of like real-time data analytics platform that takes huge amounts of data and serves all the big merchant banks out in the States and in Europe. And then it's got an IT services. What's your sort of latest view on this one? Because it's come off its lows. I think they were about £13, £14. It's about £17.5. Obviously, the KX Insights are a real driver, but the IT services business is a good solid cash generator. But I'm not too sure about sort of like corporate IT spend, particularly out in the States at the moment.
Yeah, look, I mean, there are three bits of this business: consulting business, a MarTech business, and then the KX business, as you talked about. The consulting business, yes, it's going to ebb and flow with demand, but it is a good quality enterprise. And these three businesses are increasingly siloed. They're not, they used to be, there still is to some degree a rationale for keeping them together. But I think as the businesses grow and develop, there is scope perhaps for these to be disaggregated, to be spun off in time. So I think we have to look at them all separately. Yes, the consulting business, there are some challenges around spend right now, but it's still a quality enterprise, good cash generation. We think is in a good place. MarTech, a bit slower given the environment that's within marketing spend is obviously under a bit of pressure. But KX, that's the exciting bit, and that's what really, you know, it's what everyone's getting revved up about. It's got some partnerships with some of the great hyperscalers, AWS, Microsoft, Snowflake, another leading industry player. And its ARR is up, well, average, sorry, annual recurring revenues are up 40% over the last year. And I think, and it's just getting started, 63 million right now, 65 million. You know, it's not cheap on a multiple, but you've got to look through the longer term picture. This thing, I don't think will be in its current form in 2 or 3 years' time. I think there's massive scope for growth here. It's a leading UK tech business. It's actually Northern Irish, but it's a leading British tech business. Very few of those around. And I think these guys are the real deal. And the chief exec of the KX business has been around the States. We've met him a few times as well. He knows who he's dealing with. He knows the market in which he's operating. This is structured data. This is, you know, processing large quantities of this stuff. It's not easy to do. There's very few players. And the fact that AWS and Microsoft and Snowflake, they're all reselling you, that's credibility in itself. And the business is just delivering. So you're right. I mean, I'm looking at the multiples in this thing just now, and it's trading on 40 times. So your viewers are going to go, "Well, I don't want to buy this, Chris. It's usually expensive." But, you know, it was on 53 times. You know, that's the growth that we're seeing in this business, and I think that's the ultimate that you've got to look at. So the growth rate is fantastic. It's still very exciting. I think the numbers in the market, it's showing an EPS CAGR of about 10%. It's clearly wrong. I think it's massive upside. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the KX Insight, that picks and shovels on the generative AI, is just a fabulous business, because it doesn't matter who's going to put in, you know, who's going to win in the AI space, but they are, because they're the picks and shovels. They're a bit like the Nvidia, because they're the only ones in town who can do that real-time mass data, isn't it, for the capital markets. So, and
I wouldn't say the only one, folks. I'm not going to claim to be an expert, but they clearly are in the right space with the right stuff, and people want to play with them. So, you know,
Now, just moving again to another fairly large sort of business, 600 million, Learning Technologies. Now, this one was a darling of the sort of market of AIM, ran about sort of, I don't know, 2 years ago. The shares have dropped off after a profit warning. They're now trading at less than 10 times PE, which just seems fabulous value for an asset of this quality. But I guess what the market is trying to deal with is it going to be disintermediated by generative AI, like Chegg has been in the education sector out in the States? Because obviously, well, just I mean, learning techs do corporate IT learning and digitization, and help businesses improve the talent management of their employees.
The AI discussion, there's a long way to go. I was out seeing a corporate that we have a position in last week, and they're also being questioned around AI and how they're positioned. I think we don't know at this stage. I think it's too early to tell. I think, you know, companies are using AI than they have been for some time. So to say that AI is going to replace this business, you know, I think it's far too early. These guys have got good clients. They've got credible scale. I mean, the market, the revenues in this business are still 600 million. This is not a small enterprise. Yes, they've had a downgrade last week or the week before, and this is the second one. Having spoken to the management, I think this is it. I think they had some issues. They did a big deal in the States, GP Strategies, and they had some challenges around integrating that and getting into the business properly. I think that's all been dealt with now. And it's really, from my perspective, a valuation call, Paul. I think, you know, this was a market darling, and looking back at its historic. I like to look back at historic multiples, and this thing was at a 5-year average PE of 24 times. It's now 9 times. You know, will it get back to 24? Probably not, but it probably deserves to trade on 14, 15 times on a relatively modest outlook, given the scale. You know, yes, it has got a bit of debt right now, but it is a cash generative business that will pay that debt down quickly. And that, you know, I think it's dealing with GP, it's paying its debt down. It'll then start to, I think, consolidate the sector again and buy more technology. So I think at this multiple, it is extremely attractive. I think the management team will be very chastened by the downgrades. I don't think they want to put another one out there. I think they've learned the lessons. They don't want to be sitting here to put down year to date 50% or down the last 6 months 50%. I think, you know, from my perspective, I think this is a very interesting entry point, and I think there's definite scope for a re-rating from these levels.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would agree, to be perfectly honest, because I do understand a lot of that business is to do with sort of regulated industries. It's teaching
Exactly.
and training, and they have the proprietary data that you can't scrape by the likes of ChatGPT, which has undermined Chegg, and therefore they have that, they can provide those proprietary training services for regulated industries that engineers have to actually perform. It's not this discretionary, I'm a first year student and I'll go to Chegg rather than, you know, it's going to go to ChatGPT rather than buy a book. You know, it's very much you have to do it, and it's a mandated activity, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. You can't go and scrape the data and copy the
I
essay. I mean, that's not allowed. So no, you're right. They've got a position. They've got great client base.
know.
As you say, they're operating in an industry that need them. And yes, the business model will evolve with AI. But lots of businesses are evolving with AI. But we're not at the point yet that we can say the business is in serious trouble. I think it's other things. It was a GP deal. It was the consolidation of that very different business into learning tech. And I think that's hopefully they're behind them. And these levels, say 9x on an FY2 basis, is an attractive entry point in my view.
Yeah, no, I'm going to have a good look at it myself. Now, another one which has been through the ringer has come down a lot. 600 million odd market cap, just over GB Group, which basically, again, was a bit of a darling 2 or 3 years ago. Got a bit of a US private equity interest, I think, at about £5 last year. It's trading at, say, around about, what, 250,
250, yeah.
245 at the moment. It does sort of like all things online verification, location sort of like verification as well, and should be in theory a beneficiary of sort of like generative AI, as more people are sort of like worried about people sort of pretending to be others and impose, you know, imposters of cybersecurity. They should see a sort of bit of a tailwind from this one. What's your sort of latest view on this one? Because it's not massively cheap, but it is on trough earnings, and hopefully they should see margin expansion going forward.
My view, the stock has been a challenge, but you know, there's been a number of things, a few headwinds. They were involved to some relatively modest degree, but ID verification around crypto last year, that's obviously gone away, although crypto has recovered, so it might be back, I don't know. But there's been a few headwinds for the business, but ultimately it is identity verification. It is, in our view, one of the leading players within the space. It's a massive market. Their revenues are still relatively modest from a market share perspective. I don't think it'll take a lot to get growth back for this business. As you say, there could be some tailwinds as the industry looks to evolve in due course. And it's trading on 14 times. Now, again, looking back at that 5-year average, 30, 33 times has been the 5-year multiple. Now, again, I'm not suggesting to viewers that it gets back up to that level, given that growth is clearly a bit more challenged in the short term. But I think it's been through its challenges. I think it's dealing with the issues and the headwinds that it's had. I think management are focused on growth again. It has got the underpin of a private equity interest, as you say, at a higher level. Whether that comes to anything, I don't know. But you know, again, it's a stock that I'm looking at from a recovery perspective. It's in pretty good shape. It's got, you know, it's a business which I think it's got scope for turnaround. It's got scope for margin expansion. It's got scope for some top line in due course, and it's a massive market, and it doesn't take much, you know, I think, to get that really moving. So again, I think from this level at 14 times on an FY2 basis, again, it's an interesting stock to be having a look at these levels.
Yeah, I think all four of those are real top quality assets, no doubt about it, which all could be. I mean, the amount of M&A we've had from overseas interest, any of those could be taken out because they're good chunky businesses and they add a lot of sort of like differentiation. Now,
Market leadership, good tech behind them,
yeah.
well invested, all that stuff that we like. I mean, see, we ask what sort of investors we are. We're growth investors, but we like to buy businesses that we believe have got, you know, some semblance of a moat, some semblance of, of a quality management team, decent balance sheet, scope for growth. Our average net debt to EBITDA across our portfolios is 0.1 times. Our businesses generally are quite well capitalized, and that again, in this market, should leave them the ability to go and do some M&A themselves, not be taken out. But if they are, you know, we've seen a couple of takeouts over the last 6 months. We've had Medica, we've had SureServe, and the takeout premiums in those stocks 30 to 40%. I think that's just indicative of how much value there is in this end of the market. And just some of the points earlier on, we were talking about small caps and where the market is, but you know, the market's on sub 10 times earnings multiples. If you look at that on a blended basis, We've only seen that five times in the last 20, 25 years. If you look back over the last three times from, you know, the financial crisis in 2011 and 2020, when it got to these levels, the market in the following 2 years recovered by about 40%. That's the IA all companies. The IA smaller companies grew by 20% more. So that, again, gives us real comfort that this end of the market is exciting. There's, you know, great scope for re-rating when it happens. And the smaller end of the market, having been more oversold, will bounce back even further. So, again, that keeps us excited by you know, the current frustrations aside. Yes. It keeps us excited by with where we are. Where we are.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's, you know, they've been battered for such a long time. And it's just primed, isn't it? Just all it needs is a bit of less bad news to really turn that and bring the liquidity back into the market, and people see the value. This is going to go through the roof, hopefully. Anyway, that's a theory.
Now,
one stock which just turned into the old economy, which is a recovery and has turned through a bit of the mill as well, is a Trifast, which does sort of like industrial fasteners, and I think has been hit recently from sort of customer destocking, a profit warning, and I think the CEO has resigned as well. It trades at about 13 times market cap, back to about 120 mil. What's your sort of latest view on this one? It's a bit of an outlier, actually, in your portfolio, because it has got quite a chunky amount of debt in a EBITDA perspective, about sort of over 1.5 times.
Which it's managing, yes. This is a business which does fasteners. Now you say, what are fasteners? Well, they're the bits within your washing machine that hold it all together, basically, all the component parts get put in. And you know, the fasteners are relatively low cost, but crucial. Can't fail, because ultimately, if they do fail, the whole enterprise, whole machine fails. Now, they obviously saw some challenges around COVID. They saw some challenges around destocking post-COVID. They saw some challenges around some of the manufacturing in Eastern Europe getting impacted by the war last year. And then they had another destocking issue earlier on this year with one particular Chinese client. And that caught the market by surprise. Now, there has been a management change. There is, in our view, a really high quality interim CEO in this business who was a non-exec and who stepped up. He'll be there for between 1 and 2 years. Below him, there's a really high quality COO, and these guys both live and breathe fasteners. They've been there for a long time. They know the market really well, and they're getting to grips with some of the issues that perhaps hadn't been dealt with internally. There are some parts of the business, arguably the UK, too much cost in this business that was holding back the potential for margin recovery. This sort of stuff under the surface is all getting dealt with. They're looking at contracts now on a true profit basis, is a term that they use. So it's basically looking at the ultimate EBITDA and the working capital that's used within that contract and putting a sensible cost of debt on that basis. And every single contract has been reassessed in that, and they've got rid of the contracts which are not making the money, or they've renegotiated them, so they're getting the price ups put through. As I say, this is crucial to, you know, their end customers. Once you're designed in, they don't normally want to design you out, because ultimately that involves some element of testing, etc., and they don't want things to fail by bringing in a cheaper supplier. So they have got that ability to put up pricing, which I think they didn't appreciate previously. So that is now coming through as well, and they're all these little things under the surface have been dealt with. And I think the business now is in a far better footing looking forward for some semblance of economic recovery. And as and when it does, I think this business is well poised for growth. Now, you're right, it's had an issue with debt. It's paying that down. But it's trading on 10 times. You look a year out. That, again, looking back at that five-year average, 13, 14 times. You know, the growth rate in this business as it starts to recover, with earnings growth from 2022 to 2024 of over 20% on a CAGR basis, compound annual growth rate basis. That's pretty attractive in that sort of multiple. And I think those numbers are relatively conservative. I'd expect them, given the management have been through the mill with this, given the fact they've had these issues, they've dealt with them, I think, pretty well. And I think the expectations are pretty prudently set. So I would hope those numbers have got scope to be beaten. So all these things put together, management team, you know, good customer relationships, cheap rating. You're right, it's an old economy stock, but we still need to make things, Paul. And these guys are involved in that process, and they're doing it well. So I think it's quite interesting. These levels, from a recovery perspective, from a GDP, you know, recovery perspective in 2 or 3 years' time, as well as some self-help, I think this thing is one to consider.
Well, one thing that a lot of investors have questioned about Trifast is, well, what is the USP for it? Well, what's the differentiator that it has against the sort of the Asian fastener makers and, you know, the really low, even the lower cost ones?
Well, I think it's that quality aspect. You know, these guys have a good client relationship. As I said, they have been able to put through price increases. The clients want to keep them in the most case, because ultimately, but they want fasteners which won't fail. And I say it's a relatively small element of the total production cost or whatever it's going into. But if it's wrong, then the whole thing doesn't work. So they need to, and I think the client base knows that. And I say that the interim CEO, the COO, these are guys who are well versed in the fastener world, and I think they've got great relationships, and they're capitalizing on that. So I think you're right. There's always a risk, and certain customers will switch to other suppliers. But there's still a big market out there for quality, and these guys do provide it.
Yeah, okay. Now, just switching sectors to all things sort of real estate or estate agents and letting agencies, Foxtons. It's I think most of the business actually is letting, so it's probably done pretty well. Trades at reasonable sort of less than market valuations, about 120 million market cap. What's your sort of latest view on this one? I think it's run by, is it CEO Guy Gittins, who's been there for some time, who loves estate agents, I guess.
Have you ever met him? He is
a
force of nature. You come out of the meeting with him, Paul, exhausted because of his enthusiasm. it's great. We had him in last week for a chat, and look, this business. He was in Foxtons. He went off, traveled around the estate agency world. Was at Chesterton's, and has come back into Foxtons. And I think there's been a cultural shift in this business. When you and I were younger, you know, Foxtons was somebody you never wanted to let a flat off. You knew you'd end up in the wrong place paying too much. But as a client, you wanted to use them because they were going to get you the best. And they lost that kudos. They lost that market position. I think he's coming back. He's reinvigorating the business. He's reinvigorating the call centers, which had, you know, been a previous driver of leads, but at, you know, they shrunk the number of people within those call centers by, I think, 60-70%, maybe more than that. So he's starting to reinvest in these parts of the business, and it drives leads. It drives lettings leads right now, but their market share in sales in London was 15%. It's down at 3 roughly right now. The market share of new sales instructions at the last count was almost 8%. So they're starting to rebuild that book as well. So the business itself has got its core stable base of lettings. It gives it good levels of visibility. It gives it sensible levels of growth. You know, lettings, I said to him last week, what happens if lettings come down? He said that's not going to happen. We have never seen that. Yes, you might see the growth in letting costs decline a bit, but we won't see them come back. So that's a really quality stable base, which are growing, they're buying in books, and then they've got the sales aspect as well. Right now that's not making them any money, but as and when the market starts to recover, this business is well poised for further upside. I think the EBIT in this business is high teens right now. I think a peak was 45 million. I'm not saying it gets back to that 45 million level, but it might get somewhere in between. The market isn't pricing it at this point on 11 times. It thinks it's an estate agency business, and that's it. It's clearly more than that. I say the reinvigorated management team, who has basically said to me a couple of times, he gets properly paid when his share price gets to 70p. He's at 38.5p right now. So there's decent water between that and his end game. And as I say, he is a force of nature. I think he's the right guy to get this business really moving. So it's a recovery place for people that want to look through stocks that will recover when the market starts to recover. And I think this is one which is well placed for that.
Good. Okay. Well, again, just sort of moving to another sector, healthcare. And I think it's one of them we called HVivo is led by another sort of rock star CEO, Yamin Khan, I think Mo is his name.
Okay.
Is.
Yeah.
And basically, this business does sort of like, it's a contract research organization that does challenge trials for vaccine sort of like, you know, development, and has actually just won an enormous £13 million contract with a top 5 biotech business across the world. So it obviously is knocking on the right doors, or people are knocking on its doors. I'm not sure, but anyway, can you take us through this one? Because it seems to have been a really strong economic moat, as you talked about, because not many people can do these challenge trials, I understand.
No, challenge trials are taking, it's basically a way of speeding up the point to drugs getting approved, but using these human challenge trials, which are generally lower cost than going down the more traditional routes. And it's taken a while for the market to really believe that these things are, you know, they're effective. They do have a credible place within within drug trials. And it's starting to get to that credibility point. I think Pfizer is our largest client, and they've got a drug to market from using a human challenge trial to speed things along. So lower cost, faster routes to market. And it's, you ask them what the USP is. Well, they're taking human, non-ill patients, as it were, and injecting them with these viruses, and then basically testing them for all sorts on the way through. It's quite hard to do from a perspective of getting the actual dosing right so it is effective. You can put too much of a dose into a well patient and the drug won't have the efficacy, or you can put too little in and the drug is too much. It's got to be a real balance. And these guys, it's not about their infrastructure, because anybody can set up a ward and put some beds in it. Paul, you could be doing it this week if you wanted to.
I'd need a regulatory approval, though, wouldn't I?
But it's more the actual nuances of the trial itself, which these guys have got the skill set, and they are delivering and getting some credibility. It's a massive market. If all trials for these sorts of drugs decide to use human challenge trials, it's a vast market. It's and these are the market leader, a relatively small UK-based business, 125 million market cap. Yes, there will be others who will come along and emulate it if it is successful, but it's a huge market with vast budgets. And all they have to do is get a relatively modest share of that pie, and this business could be a multiple of its current size. So I think it's really exciting. It's again, not hugely expensive, not hugely cheap, 18, 19, 20 times, but with that potential for growth. And the numbers in the market have got relatively modest EPS progression, 5% CAGR in the next couple of years. But as you say, they won a big contract recently. It's giving them good visibility. Visibility for this year's done, partly a decent chunk for next year. And these contracts tend to last for a couple of years. So they're getting some good visibility. I think there'll be upgrades to these numbers. And as I say, they've got a real potential, you know, angle as this market grows, and they'll grow with it.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think also another point that I think some investors miss is that the importance or significance of vaccine development is becoming more and more critical now across the whole sort of therapeutic areas, because given we've now got those mRNA type vaccines from Moderna, from BioNTech, et cetera, for things like RSV, or for cancer, or autoimmune. These are new areas that have never been used for vaccines, because, you know, to basically get that immune response from the individual. So it actually is becoming a bigger pie of the medical pot, hasn't it? Essentially.
It's becoming accepted. It's become a bigger market, and these processes are becoming accepted within it. And I think that's, you know, there's really good tailwinds here for this market that they're operating within. And I'd say they're a small operator, but there's not many people doing this.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, an area that's got some more challenged area is sort of the consumer, but one really bucking the trend is Marks Electrical, which is run by another CEO who's absolutely devoted to the industry, Mark Smithson, and he basically has sort of modelled or refined and beaten the likes of AOL and John Lewis and Currys and stuff, and he's knocking the ball out of the park in terms of shifting white goods around the UK. Do you want to take us through this one? Because it really has beaten its competitors, both in the marketplace and on its share price, actually. In fact, it's not that far off from one of its IPO. I think IPO at about 110, and it's only just, it's only just south of £1 now.
Yeah. These guys, look, they're challenging up against John Lewis AOL, as you say. Market share 2%, 2% from memory. So they've got modest share in a massive market again. And all they're doing is just doing things better than the big boys. They've got coverage across the majority of the UK population, next day delivery. They'll do installations. Now, I haven't tested this, but I hear that John Lewis are now not doing installations from some of the more complex, quite good. So these guys are. They've got skilled people, trained up individuals on the trucks to do it for you. So it's good service. It's next day delivery. That's what they're focusing on. And they're just eating away at the behemoths who are a bit sleepy, and John Lewis in particular are the ones which are taking their eye off the ball. And you're now seeing Marks Electrical, you see them advertising the Tube down here. They are raising their profile, and it's, as I say, it's a huge market for them to go out. And again, this is the guy who, if you meet again, you come out of the meeting slightly exhausted. He is so passionate about what he's doing. He's really got the bit between his teeth, and he loves it. And he's got a big shareholder. I think he owns 25% more. I haven't even looked at the details today, but he's got a big share in his business. I think much more than 25%. Sorry, that's wrong. But he's clearly got the ambition to make this a much bigger business. And I can see this easily doubling in size as far as, taking that 2.5 to 5%. Why not? Why not more? I don't know. Mm. But they've got that footprint in place. They've got good relationships with the manufacturers. They get good products. They can get out to consumers quickly at the right price. And as I say, it's a sleepy market with big companies which are a bit slow. And these guys are coming at it from a quality service perspective and doing it really well.
Well, I can give you reassurance on the on kicking the tires, because I ordered a dishwasher from them about 18 months ago, and it was fabulous. I think it was on the Friday or something like that, and I had the appliance delivered into my house, into my kitchen, at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. Well, I think it was some guy, Clive, and I can't remember, Ted or something like that, and they were delivering to me, and then going up to Scotland. It was just like, wow, the whole business is, the culture's incredible.
He's done a great. So Marco owns 70-odd% of the share, so I was wrong. Yeah. He's ingrained this hopeful good culture across the business, and you sound like a satisfied customer, Paul. I've not used him, actually, I must admit. But
yeah, no, try it. It was good. Definitely worthwhile. But I haven't had a problem with the dishwasher, put it that way. Now, again, shifting, it's on the consumer side. Let's move to all things sort of interior furnishings. Sanderson Design, market cap quite small, actually, 75 mil. Sort of like designs, wallpapers, fabrics and paints. I'm guessing it's a sort of like a high-end luxury type product, a bit like Laura Ashley before it went bust. This one won't go bust, but I mean, as in like, it's sort of like something which is unique to the UK and his heritage brand. I don't know.
It's Zoffany, it's William Morris to some degree. It's high-quality product that you'll see in interior design shops. These guys, they print it in the UK, which is unusual. And they've been one of the very few beneficiaries of Brexit, because the tax regime on certain products, bringing in competitive products from elsewhere, these guys can compete because they can manufacture here. So, it is high end, mid to high end consumer. It is all about people want to spend money on their properties. And yes, right now things are probably a little bit more challenged, but they've got some quite good tie ups. They've got tie ups with some high street retailers. Have done some things with H&M in the past, Next as well, and those licensing deals with some of their products basically just drop straight through to the bottom line. So they've got a newish management team. She's been in for, I think, 2 or 3 years, maybe slightly longer, but it's turned this business around. It's really focused on the product. She knows it really well. She again comes in decked head to toe in the fabrics that she makes themselves. I mean, which again, she lives and breathes the business. Exactly, and I think that again this resonates. And the business itself was a little bit sleepy previously. You hear stories of staff going home at 3 o'clock, and the culture was wrong. She's sorted that out, and it's got massive heritage, fantastic legacy, great product set, trading on 7x earnings. It's not poised to succeed, but again, a bit like Foxton's, when people feel happy with life, these are exactly the sorts of stocks which will rewrite and grow nicely. I'd say it's a high quality niche manufacturer of high quality products in the UK. There's not many of them around. I think these guys are really well set for economic growth in due course. It's just a mode. Is it the quality modes we're talking about here? These are really hard to emulate.
It's got real brand cachet, hasn't it? And there's no doubt about it. People want its products. And the other thing to note, I think he's got 15 million of cash. So that's a 20p on its balance sheet, which is a full, it gives it a lot of sort of like wiggle room. That's for sure.
Exactly.
Another one in that sort of, it's more in the sort of the housing and construction, but it's a premium product, is a Michelmersh brick that does sort of more aesthetically bricks. I think it does sort of wire cut clay bricks, and it's sort of like he has about 5% of the UK market, but it's got good pricing power, premium stuff that goes into making houses far more attractive, and that premiumization also into infrastructure. Do you want to give us your latest on this one? Because it came out with a sort of like, well, it came out with an inline trading update of late, but I know it sort of like booked some of its energy contracts at a slightly higher rate than currently on the market, I think, with the gas side. But what's your sort of ins and outs on Michaelmas trading at pretty low valuation? I think it's less than 10 times PE, actually, with cash on the balance sheet.
It's cash on the balance sheet. It's got asset backing as well. It owns a lot of its land, which can be used for housing in due course. Mm. So there's lots of nuances to it. It's a market leader, as you say. There's a couple of things here. One of the other stocks I think we're going to talk about is Brickability. And recent news was that Michelmersh's chief exec, Frank, is leaving at some point in the next 12 months to join Brickability. It's a very small industry. There's only four or five players that make bricks, and
I think Frank knows Alan, doesn't he?
They know he's Alan. I think they went to school together. I don't know. They're very good mates. But
exactly, yeah.
Michelmersh, high quality, good pricing power, good management team, good asset backing. The only scope is where they grow from, and that's a challenge this business needs to perhaps go out and do some more deals. And I'm sure they're looking, because they've done some deals in Northern Europe in the past. These take a while. These are family businesses. They have to talk to and basically court and get to know, and people have to trust Michelmersh are a good custodian of the family enterprise. So these take time. They're very hard to know when they'll land, but I think they will do some more deals in due course. And that's the leg of growth that this business needs to push it back up to. 11, 12 times. It'll never be a highly rated company because of what it is, but it's a quality enterprise, good levels of cash generation, and I say they will do some consolidation to take themselves to the next level. Frank leaving is a disappointment, but they have got joint chief execs. Mm. I've never actually met the other chief exec yet. Never met him, but he will be coming to see us at some point relatively soon. But I think from Brickability's perspective, Frank is a great custodian. He knows what he's doing. Him and Alan are good mates, and I think they understand the challenges around the brick market right now. But Brickability, for those who don't know it sits in between the manufacturers and the importers at one end, and the house builders and merchants on the other end. And it consolidates brick imports. It breaks
it's
up.
It's a distributor, isn't it? Distributor.
It's a distributor. It's a brick factor. And it controls about 22% of the UK brick market, and you've never heard of them. But it sits in the middle with getting, high single-digit margins. And they are obviously seeing a bit more of a challenged trading environment just now, given the market conditions that we have. But Brickability is on, what, 5x earnings? I mean, it's ludicrously cheap.
Yeah.
And, at some point, the market will start to stabilize and turn, and house builders will start to grow again. Yes, right now is a challenge, obviously, around number of houses being built, but there are still houses being built. There's still demand for bricks. Mm. Yes, it's a bit softer than it has been, but as long as pricing holds up, and, look at the markets for Terra, it's Michelmersh Brick, it's Wienerberger, and it's Ibstock. I mean, it's a really tight market. That controls about 90-95% of the UK brick market. They're not going to pull prices down, I would suggest, given the market conditions and given the demands a bit softer. As long as pricing holds up, Brickability will still be able to make its high single digit margins. And I think in due course, this business should re-rate. It should be on, let's say, 10, 11 times. I'm not saying it's going to be a 20 times multiple, but it shouldn't be on five.
It's a double bagger, isn't it?
It shouldn't be in five. The market conditions look a bit more normal. It shouldn't be in five. And say Frank coming across the business is again a feather in the cap for Brickability. He's a very good quality operator, knows what he's doing. He's very good at, I think, the commercial aspect of things. And I think he can only improve this business. So Alan's done a great job. Hats off to him. Nothing negative there. He's done a fantastic job building this business through organic and through consolidation, and left it very well set. But I think with Frank at the helm, it should take it to the next level.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And also, I think the outlook for the house builders, for the Brickabilities and for Michelmersh's customers, is actually getting better, because most of them have indicated they are breaking new ground, whereas they've had to put a frozen on sort of like land purchases for 6 months to preserve their balance sheets. Now they're actually seeing light at the end of the tunnel in terms of sort of getting new sites in operation. That's obviously when the bricks and all the building products sort of get used. And now that brings us neatly onto the other one in that sector, MJ Gleeson. And what was really interesting, I thought, it did the same as I think Barrett did the same. It just sold a shed load of houses to an institutional investor, which has all the hallmarks of this is an undervalued, you know, sort of area that institutional money wants to put to play to do build to rent. Do you want to take us through your latest on sort of like, you know, MJ Gleeson and the sort of the house builders? Because it's really seems to reach a bit of an inflection point with that valuation play.
And MJ Gleeson, for those that don't know, it is a predominantly a house builder in areas of economic regeneration. So it's building for customers that are often first-time buyers. They're often young. And what we like about it is these guys can buy a house, an MJ Gleeson house, for less than they're paying on their council house rent. And given the fact these are new homes, they're more efficient, so the running costs are lower than their council house running costs. Now, with interest rates running at 5-6%, that becomes more break even as far as you know, continuing to rent or to buy a Gleeson home. But as you talked about, and we're hoping interest rates are at that, hopefully that peaking point in the next couple of months and starting to come back down again. I think Gleesons are very well set from that perspective. So the customer base, we talked about there about affordability. And who are the customers? Well, they're working in the local supermarket. They're driving the forklift truck in the local depot for Marks Electrical, whatever it might be. You know, these are customers who, you know, whilst GDP may be a bit softer in the UK, they're not going to lose their jobs. So they are happy to be taking, you know, a mortgage out on the premise that they will continue to be employed. So, you know, the really attractive dynamics. I think it's a business which I don't know why more people don't do it. They still make a 15% margin on their houses that they build. So, you know, decent returns. And yes, volumes have been a bit slower, and they've offset that by this deal from the institutional investor you talked about. I think it's Carlyle Group. And yes, that suggests, A, that there is, you know, demand for these products. Yes, it's undervalued right now. It helps Gleeson out because it gives them more cash, and, you know, just to bolster the balance sheet in the short term. But I think it just, you're right, Paul, it's indicative of the value that's around here. People want to, you know, say have these homes in the areas that Gleesons are building them. And at some point, Gleesons will, I think, be in a fantastic place. It's just a really nice model, and it's got really good longevity. And I think they can open a lot more sites. I mean, they've doubled the number of sites. I think they're producing about 2,000 per annum. You know, they've opened the infrastructure which can support them doubling those number of sites. There's a number of units being built on an annualized basis when the market recovers. This business, again, on 9x earnings, is not valued on the principle that it can double the profitability of this group in 3 or 4 years' time. I think it can. So, again, really exciting. Yes, headwind short term, but look down the track, 12, 18 months.
And it's trading at well below net tangible books. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Getting the whole business for free anyway.
I think it's great. And a good management team.
It is what's also sort of like as a sort of a potential sort of like, you know, shift for the whole industry is that these institutional investors seem to be seeing an opportunity in lettings and rebalancing the UK's property ownership and letting, because there's such a demand in rental that that effectively we need a lot more properties, not just to sell to people, but actually to rent out. And that's going to be incremental, effectively, volume in the whole market. So I don't know how many properties we have in the UK, 23 million or something like that. That could easily go to 24, 25 million with another 2 million of rental, because, I mean, that, as you rightly point out, it's absolutely just, you know, rental. I mean, London rental market is 15, 20% up, isn't it, year on year for the last 2 years?
Hence Foxton's. They're well placed for that. But Gleesons don't tend to build normally to sell to private rental investors. They're very much said they want to be building the sites for people that can live in them and owner occupy them. But the Carlyle thing was helpful. Barrett's did the same thing, as you pointed out. So it's helpful right now. You're right, there is big demand for this. But Foxton's are very much a beneficiary of that lettings market and lettings growth.
And one which is a sort of counter-cyclical play that is absolutely firing on all cylinders, which is not a surprise given the sort of the cost of living crisis, is H&T, which is the UK's largest pawnbroker and it's also a leading jewellery retailer. Its pledge book seems to be going through the roof. Its jewellery sales seem to be doing well. And even its sort of like Forex for people travelling abroad seems to be rocketing as well. I mean, what's not to like about this business? It trades at less than 8x PE.
I know, it's nonsense. It's one of our... It performed really well last year, and then it's rolled over this year. I think it's down, not down massively, down my chart here, about 5%. But you're right, it's on 6-7x earnings. It's 2-year earnings CAGR, that compound annual growth rate number we talked about earlier on, out to 2024, is 38%. Yeah, so 38% earnings growth and a 6x multiple. I mean,
the PEG ratio on that one is what? About 0.2, isn't it?
It doesn't make sense. No, yeah. I mean, look, some people don't want to be investing in these sorts of companies because they are relatively high cost credit. But, you know, pump broking is relatively high cost credit. But you talk to them and they're very mindful of that. I think they do manage the relationships with their end customers extremely well. They lend relatively small loan amounts. Now, the loan market has changed, and various products which the people that would use a pawn broker have used in the past, they've been pulled because of regulatory changes. So arguably, the client base that H&T serve have got limited choice but to perhaps go down some illegal routes to borrow money, or they use H&T. Now, you don't want to be having to borrow off the chap in the pub. It's never a nice ending in these situations. H&T regulated business, you know, a high quality business. As I say, the customers that they serve within their shop base, often they know them really well. They've been in with the shop a number of times. They build up a rapport and they keep coming back. And it creates this, you know, people need some cash. These guys can give it to you, relatively small loan amounts and what looks like relatively modest amounts of payback over a relatively modest time. So I think there's a place in the market for this sort of business. As I say, the multiple is extremely low. The loan book is growing nicely. I think there's scope for further upside. They raised some money earlier in the year to support loan book growth, which we supported. They could even do some small bolt-ons as well, which they might do in due course to bolster the shop base. I think it's in a really good place. It's now the sixth largest retailer of secondhand jewellery in the UK. So they've got some, you know, they're a jeweller as well. And the whole trend of people reusing and reselling your watches and your jewellery and et cetera, all that, I don't want to claim this as an environmental play, but it does encourage people to be reusing products as well. So there's nice aspects to that about it. It pays a nice yield for clients that want that. It's on 6% dividend yield right now. So 6% yield, 6x earnings, almost 40% earnings growth in a market where there's limited competition, the biggest in the market in the UK. Yeah, I think it's far, far, far too cheap.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Another lender, but slightly a bigger business, in fact, nearly 4 billion market cap, is Intermediate Capital Group, which I've never really sort of come across a great deal. It does sort of like mezzanine debt finance for corporates and for transactions and stuff.
Well, it's a fund manager, really, Paul. It's an asset manager. And so I'll let you finish.
Right? Yeah, no, please do. Yeah, go on. So it's more of a fund manager, asset manager with AUM, I guess, rather than actually providing a bank lending, etc.
Exactly. It's a fund manager. And it's got, you know, really good. Historically, it started out in, you know, a relatively modest market cap stock. It used to use a lot of its own capital to invest in some of these strategies. It's predominantly third-party capital that it manages, although it does use its own balance sheet to seed funds. But it's an alternative asset manager, basically. It's debt, as you talked about, being one of its core products. And it's got some, you know, we think really good scope for growth. It's AUM. I can't recall the number off the top of my head, but I think
$82 billion.
Good number. I think, you know, we talked to them relatively recently. They think they can, you know, take that to almost double these levels from, you know, from launching new products from the existing asset suite they have. They think they can get it through 100 relatively in relatively short order. So,
and is that being driven because of the interest rates rising? So more money is coming into the sort of the debt finance in private capital via credit.
It's more people just wanting to look at alternative strategies for investing. So it's not driven around the real interest rate cycle as such. It's just people wanting to broaden their exposure to some of these enterprises, and ultimately they get potentially better yields on some of these assets as well. So good returns. These guys are good at it. They're global leaders. As I say, they can grow the book nicely through 100 with existing strategies, and you know, we can layer on significantly more in due course to grow this to much, much larger enterprise. It's not the cheapest stock in the market, but it's because of what it is. It's always going to be, you know, it's never going to be sitting on a 20x multiple. That's not its nature, but it can easily be trading at a much higher level than it is right now. It's a stock which is quite high beta. So when the market sells off, Intermediate Capital sells off with it. You know, right now it's at 13.50, whatever it might be. we're very happy to hold on to it for the medium term. But you might see some investors sit back and wait. If the market rolls over a bit, this thing could easily be down 12 quid. And that's when perhaps you'll step in and buy it. But it seems a high beta name, but it's got great growth potential. It's had a great long-term track record. It's got good dividend, again, a 6% dividend yield. So this is in our income fund. But we think it's, again, very well set for long-term growth.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And there's lots of consolidation in that area. Don't be surprised if Blackstone was sort of to buy that one. I don't know, but wait and see.
I couldn't speculate. But look, I think these guys are in a really good place. They've got really good credibility. The clients like them, clearly. They're growing their assets and they're seeding new funds and new strategies. And that gives them the more products they launch, the more stability it has. And the less, I mean, in the past, the reference to its own balance sheet earlier on, it has some volatility in the past because it was its own balance sheet capital that it was using. With third party capital, it's much less volatile as far as earnings go. And again, that gives it that good earnings profile, that good earnings base. And if you look at it on that CAGR that we talked about earlier on, 14, 15 times earnings growth for the next couple of years on a compound annual growth rate basis, there'll be some debates around whether that number is, you know, up or down a bit, because obviously market conditions will dictate some of that. But ultimately, it's just a growth business on, you know, 9.8 times earnings multiples. It's too cheap. It's got some good, let's say, great cash generative characteristics, that dividend yield as well.
Okay, well, the last sector to just really quickly run through is infrastructure spending in the UK. Now, the latest UK construction PMIs came out, and they got all the headlines mainly to do with the sort of the residential property declining, which is because the media just loves negative headlines. But actually, when you cut it, when you sort of disaggregated it, the civils and the sort of like, you know, the infrastructure construction element of it was well over 50 and really on a sort of like a bit of a charge, presumably done by, you know, rail and water and all the need to upgrade and stuff. So then you've got two stocks here. You've got Renew Holdings, which does engineering services, hence higher margins. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Galliford Try, which is a more of your traditional sort of civils contractor going through a turnaround. And do you want to take us through these ones? Because, I mean, I know Renew does quite a lot of nuclear, doesn't it? And effectively rail as well and highways.
Yeah, Renew's on frameworks for, you know, regulated industries, rail, water, you mentioned nuclear, etc. So it doesn't start the year with a massive order book, but we know that they'll be, you know, when the railway line to Cornwall inevitably falls into the sea in the next big storm, these will be the guys that will fix it, yeah? They'll be out there. And, you know, it gives them that they've got great market positions. They're slowly consolidating into other sectors. They've recently done a couple of deals in rail to bolster their offering there. You know, it's an inorganic and organic growth story, trading on a very modest multiple with great long-term, you know, characteristics, good management team, good scope for upgrades, I think. It's just what's not to like about it. It will just continue to grow and deliver. And, you know, governments need to spend, regulated industries need to spend. These guys are one of the best operators within the space. And you know, they'll just grind out solid results year after year. And you meet them again, a great team with, you know, good levels of customer credibility. You know, it's just, I'm trading on, what's it on, 12 times, I'm guessing. But
It's 12 times, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's basically services for sort of like once a bit of infrastructure has been built, they do all the services to maintain it and importantly to upgrade it, because we know how dilapidated the UK infrastructure is.
Upgrades, repairs, you know, all these sorts of things. They'll be the guys, exactly. And then it needs to be done. It needs to be done more regularly. As you say, budgets are always increasing, and these guys are in prime position to benefit from that. And it says cross rail, water, nuclear. You know, all the big industries. And nuclear is, you know, it's a relatively small part of their business, but, you know, you talk about, I think they're on Sellafield and they'll be there for next, you know, decades to come doing what they're doing there. So, and they can make a good margin out of it. So I think, and they'll do more consolidation. So lots of things to like about it, even though it's not the most glamorous stock we're talking about today. But
and then Galliford Try on the other side is more of the construction and build, presumably, of the infrastructure. So if you need a new road, a new railway, you need a new sort of like, I don't know, well, anything to do
school.
With school, anything like that, then these guys do it. And they've got a gigantic order book. I think it's over 3 billion I last looked at. Huge, seems to have huge amounts of cash in terms of average level of monthly cash. They probably do need some of that for working capital, but they only trade at about 11 times PE.
If you look at it, if you put part PE to one side, I know we talked about PE for every other stock here, Paul, but this one's on an EV/EBITDA basis. Market cap, 200 and, what is it, 220?
Yeah, 207 mil I got.
207 mil. Average debt, average cash on the balance sheet, 170. Yeah? So, you know, it's on an EV/EBITDA of 1.5 times or something absolutely ludicrous. And you're right, some of that will be required for working capital. But not all of it. And they say there's a, if you talk to them in the meeting, yes, you get the average number, but they also have the minimum number. And then they always run a cash balance of well over 100 million. So they're always, you know, well capitalized. And that helps them win contracts. And the business itself, it's a contractor. It has had an issue like they all have had in the past. But, you know, I think that the new-ish management team have really got the contract risk nailed down. They do obviously approve all contracts over certain levels. They got into trouble with the Aberdeen Relief Road a couple of years ago. That was a big contract, cost overruns, etc. That would not happen under an existing manager. The way the contracts are structured, they take relatively small bites out of them and agree those terms and move on to the next bit. So they're not taking these big contract risks as they have done in the past. And it's the scope, A, to manage contracts. B, you talked about this huge order book and the revenues for the business. It's, you know, looking to this year at 1.4 billion.
Yeah.
So massive revenues and an EBITA of 2025. So really tight margins, but they're guiding to growing that margin and they are delivering on that margin growth. And they're never going to be a double digit, but they might get to 3 to 4% in due course. And that on those sorts of sales numbers, you know, on those sorts of enterprise values we talked about a minute ago, this thing is super cheap. I mean, it's up 20-25% over the last year. It's one I came in to talk to my colleagues about, and I said, I'm going to double my money in this. And they were like, no, you're not. And I still think I will. I still think there's lots of upside here. It's delivering for us. It's got, I think, a credible management team in the right place with a good balance sheet. I'd say quality assets that they're working on. They're managing them sensibly. And lots of the schools, etc., they're almost like cookie cutter schools ultimately. You build a school in Glasgow, but they've got quite lots of the book in Scotland. That's not why I like it, but it helps. They build a school in Glasgow. It's very similar to the school they build in Northumberland. It's the same kit. They know exactly how much this should cost so they can price these contracts appropriately and win them. So I think, again, it feeds into the government infrastructure spend. Again, the country needs infrastructure and needs, you know, investment. It's you know, the state budgets continue to grind higher, and these guys again are well placed and are winning contracts and delivering them well on time, on budget, and winning more. And the order book is growing. So again, not the sexiest stock, but again, you know, it's scope for upside here as well.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think, you know, you can look at sort of all the different places in the market, but actually sometimes things that are right in front of your nose are the most obvious, where you can just get a really low risk type, good solid return over a 3 to 4 year. I mean, if you could double your money over 3 to 4 years, I'd take that any time of the
Absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely, right now.
and pay a dividend. And the tailwind is the UK infrastructure. You just got to look at the PMIs, and it's been improving, no doubt about it. So it's been doing all the heavy lifting. Okay, well, thanks very much, Chris, for your time. If anybody wants to invest in the Octopus funds that you run, how best to do that?
We are across all platforms, Paul. So your usual Hargreaves Lansdown, JJ Bells, etc. If they did want to or want any more information, please do drop us a line, and we'll have to.
And there's plenty of stuff on the website, I guess, for people to download and have a look at your sort of strategy and your latest fact sheets and stuff.
I'm going to dig around a video of me talking.
Well, I might watch that then in that case. All right. Well, thanks again, Chris, and look forward in touching base in 6 months' time.
Thanks, Paul. Good speak.
Thanks. Bye.
Cheers.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.